offended. I can understand people being offended.
Really didn't have any foresight as to
the demand for online advertising has, well, during my time, it basically dipped into the vert point.
It is Thursday, the 12th of October, 2017, and welcome to the Simon Delt podcast. Now, we've got a fantastic show lined up for you today. We're going to kick off with our usual spin cycle segment. And of course, we welcome back Dr. Edwina Luck and Patrick Condren to help us tackle some of the latest stories from the last week. We're going to talk about the latest Dove campaign, which has obviously caused a big Twitter storm. We're going to talk about what you can and can't use as ingredients in granola. And we're going to discuss a few other bits and pieces as well. So that's the first segment, the spin cycle. My second segment, the interview this week, is with a gentleman called Peter Roper from Melbourne, Victoria. And that's Australia, for all of those who are perhaps listening in Australia. And Peter is the former editor, assistant editor, and associate publisher of Niche Media, and specifically in Niche Media, one of his roles was that editor and associate publisher for Marketing Magazine. And Marketing Magazine is a fantastic industry magazine that pretty much covers every base of marketing that you could possibly think of. So we're going to get some insights and some thoughts of him around the industry, and we're going to ask him how he feels it's changed. We're going to talk about the Armageddon of magazine and publishing in general. A very, very interesting interview, and well worth listening to. And then we're going to close off today with my review of another product or service that you can find and use for your business that I think will add benefit. So without any further ado, let's cut straight in and talk to the guys in the Spin Cycle. So welcome to the second episode of The Spin Cycle, and somewhere in their palatial residence across Brisbane is QUT's Dr. Edwina Luck, guru of all things marketing and advertising. And also joining us is the bivouacked somewhere in a moth-eaten tent is Patrick Condren, journalist extraordinaire. How are you two this evening?
Hello,
I think it's funnier
Simon.
Every time you say it.
I know it does, doesn't it? It's... I've got a team of writers who work with me for this sort of thing. You know?
Can I offer you a suggestion?
You can offer it to me, but I probably won't listen.
Good call, Simon. Good call.
So I think we're going to start with Dr. Luck tonight.
We are,
what have you got
Simon,
for us,
thank
Eddie?
You. Yes, well, the brand that's brought us real beauty for many, many years and spent millions of dollars promoting diversity and how obviously their products are going to help these women, Dove has made a huge blunder with on social media by showing, well, they've shown a few images. One, a black woman removing her top to reveal a white woman underneath, supposedly, of course, after using Dove body lotion. Another image showed a white woman becoming an Asian woman. And Simon, I know you know the third one. You saw that one.
Yeah, I'm not sure the third one was an Asian woman. I think the third one was a Latino woman. My understanding was a rotating GIF. Mm. I think it lasted about 6 seconds, and it had that transition from black woman to white woman to Hispanic woman.
Mm. So what message were they trying to commute?
Well, obviously the Twitter sphere, who was up in arms about this, believed that the message that they were trying to get across was that black is dirty and white is clean. So, you know, and obviously, you know, once the Twitter sphere gets hold of something like that.
Yeah, sure, I get that. But why? I've seen it. I wasn't particularly offended. I can understand people being offended, but I don't know why.
Well, I think
they're offended.
Well, basically, you're judged by the colour of your skin in many countries, and certainly Dove are an American company. And what is considered beautiful, obviously, it is in the eye of the beholder, but it does tie back really strongly to racism, and that's what they've been accused of. So, yes, it
okay. Maybe someone can explain to me what Dove was trying to achieve.
Wow.
I'm not sure Dove could explain to you what they were trying to achieve.
I totally agree. Okay,
I think the general consensus is that the idea being is that Dove products are suitable for all women. I think it's that kind of, you know, all women are equal, empowering, that kind of thing.
What about this for a notion then? Given that Dove, this isn't the first time that Dove has run foul of this sort of thing, mm-hmm. particularly with allegations of, you know, racism and inappropriate images, that sort of thing. Did they do it deliberately to create a media storm and therefore get themselves more free publicity?
I don't even think they were smart enough to do that, Pat. Many brands do, and they certainly use social media to do that and create buzz and create chat, as you say, Simon, on social media, on Twitter.
Yep.
Because there are only a certain type of demographic on Twitter and they love to vent. But I don't think so, Pat. I just think they really didn't have any foresight as to, well, they probably thought they'd offend some people, but I don't think they thought it would be a storm.
Yeah. I think for the people to sit there and have sat there and gone, this is a great idea in Dove or the advertising agency, I just don't believe that. I don't believe that there wasn't someone within all the checks and balances of a global corporation or a major advertising agency that thought, surely this is going to create some sort of issue somewhere along the line. Now, if they did think that and they knew that that was actually going to happen, then the question is that the right sort of publicity? Is deliberately poking the hornet's nest of Twitter the correct strategy for growing your brand? And it is a hornet's nest, and it is an echo chamber of opinion. Mm. So how many people that vented on Twitter
are now no longer going to buy Dove products?
Well, that's the, you know, you could, if 1,000 people on Twitter said, I'm never buying a Dove product again, would Dove sit there and go, yeah, so what?
Exactly. Right, absolutely.
Which lends to the bigger question is the drama and
mayhem
that's caused by a Twitter outrage, is that really in this day and age still damaging to a brand?
I don't think so. I think it just goes off out into the ionosphere and people move on. We were a disposable society, and we've become even more disposable when it comes to our thoughts these days. There is no, unless it's a major thing. But something like this, storm in a teacup springs.
The problem is though, Pat,
It's Dove, maybe storm in a decaf.
The thing is, it gets picked up and run by all, you know, the blogs, newspapers. It's not just Twitter. And I know, and you all know, that only a small percentage of the population are on Twitter. But it's the other stories. It's the people who Google Dove, and automatically these issues come up. So they've got to get smarter. They've got to do better, as a lot of advocates and models and celebrities have been calling on Dove, because they have been doing a great job and now they turn around and do this. It doesn't fit with their brand. It doesn't fit with their brand values.
I think the interesting thing I look at now with Dove is that if they run one of those, I'm just trying to think of a couple of their campaigns, you know, where they had the different body shape women all in the same picture and all that kind of thing. If they run that sort of advert now, the question is, who cares? You know, there's a lot of brands out there that are doing stuff with, you know, talking about body positivity and women being equal and all those kind of things. But they've all jumped on that bandwagon, and you kind of go, well, perhaps if Dove had run another campaign like that, nobody would have cared, and that this is their solution to drawing attention to their brand.
We've been talking, I have opened another window on my computer, typed in Dove, and the top stories from The Guardian, SBS and Nine Honey is quotes from the African-American Dove woman who says, I am not a victim. I'm not a victim, and Dove model responds to racism backlash.
Yeah.
Well, it's confusing the customers of Dove because they thought they knew the values of the Dove brand, and now whether this model comes out and goes, well, I'm not the victim, a lot of people are going, well, I don't understand what you stand for, who you are, and if I don't understand you, why should I use you on my body?
Yeah. It's a strange one. It's a very strange one. I'm not quite sure what Dove were thinking in the background there. But we'll move on. Patrick, would you like to bring on your little gem that you found this week?
I have indeed. And it plays well into the condition I find myself in, having overindulged in some wine last night at a work function. McGuigan Wines, this really tickled my fancy. I have seen it out and about when I've been driving around the streets. There's a series of three photos, two women and a bloke, and they've all got the expressions of, ickiness, horror, disgust on their faces, and they're holding a glass of wine. And the caption is, next time, bring a McGuigan. So it breaks the mold of the beautiful vineyard shots at dawn or dusk, and the flowing wine and the oak barrels and all that sort of stuff. And I think it really resonates because while I don't drink McGuigan wine necessarily myself, I've certainly been to. Pardon?
They do have some lovely drops.
She said knowingly. I think we've all been in the situation where someone's poured you a glass of wine at a function or at someone's house and you've drunk it and gone, oh, that's terrible.
Yes.
More often than not, it's when I take the wine that they go, that's terrible. So maybe next time I will try a McGuigan. But I just thought it was clever. I thought it was intelligent, clever, and taking the piss out of themselves, I suppose.
I think it's interesting. Sorry, I was going to say it's interesting because wine to me is one of the most, as you said, it's such generic advertising.
Yes.
The barrels and the
sweeping
and the
vineyards
and people swigging and especially the one that you see so much is the wine actually being poured into a glass as if. It splashing up the side is somehow, going to reinforce the brand values with you.
And it's a clever, it's clever because I think anyway, because if you're in a bottle shop, the ad would resonate, I think, if you're looking for bottles of wine and you saw a McGuigan, you'd go, oh, that ad, that was a clever ad, I'll take the McGuigan.
There was a very similar campaign a few years ago that I used to show in my class, and I obviously the brand didn't resonate with me, but it was all about trade in your a dodgy bottle, and it was very much the same sort of ilk as this campaign, Pat. So it's a great one you found, and it really stands out because and McGuigan, they don't advertise a lot, and what they're doing with this campaign, they're using a whole suite of integration through these ones are good, as you said, out of home. They're using print, office display, definitely promotion in bottle shops, and they're also pushing this on social media. So it's great in Australia, but they're also rolling it out in the UK, which is so clever.
Yes.
I guess the question I've got for the both of you then is humour the right vehicle for a wine brand? Humour's used massively when it comes to beer because it's such a blokey, fun, most of us think it's fun, fun product.
Unless you have too much of it. And then it inevitably ends in tears.
But is fun the right vehicle for wine? I always think wine is such a
product. I don't think it's a fun ad. Right. I just think it's clever. I think it is. It's an ad. It's a clever ad that resonates. I don't necessarily know that it's fun. It's self-deprecating. It's not self-deprecating. It's having a go at every other wine.
Absolutely. Yeah. And who's heard of McGuigan?
It's having a go at every other wine.
And McGuigan don't advertise.
But I don't really think it's fun.
Yeah.
So you could use that same argument with the typecast wine ads you know, if you drink this wine, it comes from a beautiful place and you're surrounded by beautiful people who are having a wonderful time. And all you have to do is drink this wine.
Yeah.
You know, they don't show you this shot, the same scene 5 hours later when everyone's pissed and rolling around on the floor.
And there's a fight out the back. And that
yeah, someone's
thing.
Gone the knuckle out the back and it's all over Red Rover. The cops have arrived. You know.
See, I'd like to see a wine advert like that.
Yes.
See, that would, that.
Yes, let's do that. This wine's so good.
Let's pitch that somewhere. Someone will buy into that.
Okay, we're going back to the UK. I'm cutting in on the police and the fight.
Yes, the fun UK, police have arrived.
Yeah, I've arrived. So huge competition would be Jacob's Creek in the UK. No one's heard of McGuigan. Everyone knows of Jacob's Creek, say if it's an Aussie wine. And, hey, Jacob's Creek has some great wines too. But McGuigan, this is a perfect awareness campaign. If they came in with the rolling vineyards and people stomping on grapes, people would go, well, who are these people? They're just...
Yeah. Yep. It sets them apart.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. So onto my one,
Simon,
actually.
Yes.
So,
always got to bring it back to himself.
Wow. I feel left out if I don't. The there is a bakery, the Nashoba Brook Bakery, that the other week received a warning letter from the US Food and Drug Administration telling them that they weren't allowed to list love as an ingredient in their granola. Now, so they're allowed to mention the oats, the sugar and the nuts, but they're not allowed to mention the fact that there are feelings in there.
And what was their reason?
The list for their product.
Was it puffery or something?
Well, and this is the letter. Love is not love is not a common or usual name of an ingredient and is considered to be an intervening material because it is not part of the common or usual name of an ingredient.
Isn't it an outcome as well? Like you can love while you're eating your cereal?
Is that what happens when you eat your cereal in the mornings?
Wow, I'm never coming to breakfast at your place.
Oh, it was mid-morning this morning. It was
Bring some wine when you go for breakfast.
That's a great idea. Oh, it's regulations, smegulations. This is going too far.
It seems a rather harsh... And the actual chief executive officer of the bakery said that the whole thing felt very George Orwell.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm with the administrators in this department.
Really?
I think it is absolutely ridiculous.
absolutely
ridiculous.
Yeah, right there.
Say that it's made with love. But love isn't something that you can put in a bowl.
Okay.
You
can. The chef puts in love in the kitchen making it.
So, you know, a teaspoon of, can I have a teaspoon of love in my granola? So by extension, you could put a teaspoon of hate in there as well.
Well, you could. Well, fancy. Yeah. Think of all the things that you could make with hate.
Differentiate.
Absolutely. But I think it is, no one... eating or buying that granola is going to actually believe that there is love in the granola.
Well, no.
In terms of advertising, in terms of, you know, sorry, Ed, I'm going to have to cut you off. I've had a big teaspoon of hate before I started this. I just, it's, you know, be a bit cleverer.
Oh, cleverer. So I have twin girls who turned 20 just yesterday, I must say. But when they were learning how to cook, if they had an argument or if we didn't cook with love, then the food would taste pretty much substandard. And so
with love.
That's right.
Sure, but this bakery is saying there is love in the granola. Which is patently absurd.
don't you think that most people would look at that and go, yeah, of course there is, and just eat the granola?
That's
most
right.
thinking
and
people
I mean,
would
does
say,
it really need,
stick, st- most it need thinking that people would say, take your granola and shove it where the sun don't shine.
Wow.
Oh,
sure, say it was made with love, but there's not love in there. That's just stupid. It's peace, love, mung beans, lots of farting, hippie stuff.
These these guys at the federal, who is at the FDA, they must have, must be a quiet day, because honestly,
I think this is the sort of stuff that they should be cracking down on. Absolutely. This sort of idiocy.
Maybe love could be used as a process like halal is, you know, so it's, you know, love certified food and halal certified food.
If you're not going to take this seriously, Simon.
I think that
annoys me. It gets on my tits because it's so stupid.
It's sanitary. That's what it is.
Has come out now.
I'll say you need a wine to get rid of.
Oh, that's the last thing I need. All I'd be doing is topping up.
It is quite interesting that the letter also contains some from the FDA contains some comments about how the food had been prepared, packed, or held under insanitary conditions. So it's funny because I think the company that have obviously released this letter that the FDA sent them have gone, well, this is potentially a bad letter because we're being questioned about the way in which we prepare the food, but they've kind of turned it round and gone, you know, here we are, the FDA telling us what we can and can't put into our food or put on our labels and those side of things. So,
well, I just hope the Neshoba Bakery is getting a lot more business and maybe a lot more love.
We'll find out.
I hope it goes out of business.
I don't know. I'm going to check in on this story in a few weeks.
I hope they close it down.
See if you can get some granola ordered to Australia for us, and maybe we could maybe we could all come round yours for breakfast.
Oh, that would be nice.
Can I tell you, I'm on Twitter. And there's no mention of the love story, but the Dove ad continues to run on Twitter. CNN International, a woman featured in a controversial Dove ad, says the company should have defended its creative vision. Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. There you go. It seems that, you know, that racism is the way forward if you want to draw attention to yourself, as per as Donald Trump has found out. Over the last few months. So on that note, I think we'll wind up today's episode of The Spin Cycle. So thank you very much for my panelists, Patrick Condren and Dr. Edwina Luck. I shall leave you to your palatial residences and your moth-eaten tents, and hope you recover from your hangover, Patrick.
Well, can I just tell you, I had to see the doctor the other day, and I went in and I said, I don't know if I'm a wigwam or a teepee. He said, it's clearly your two tents.
On that note, we'll leave it right there. Thank you very much, guys. My guest today is Peter Roper. He is the former editor, assistant editor, and associate publisher for Niche Media with Marketing Magazine. And he's been doing that for about 7 or 8 years. And prior to that, he was actually a teacher in Nanjing University in China. So I'm going to ask him a little bit about that as well. But welcome, Peter.
Thanks, Simon.
Great. How are things with you there?
Good. Thank you.
Just to set the scene, you've got a couple of weeks off, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right.
So Niche Media.
Former editor and associate publisher of Marketing Magazine until very recently, but as of about 10 days ago, I am now unemployed, or as I like to say, on sabbatical. So, yeah, it's very easy, but yeah.
It's unemployed to everyone else. It's on sabbatical to your wife, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah. So I'm meant to be writing a book or something. I don't know.
Okay. Well, you can tell us a little bit more about that in a minute. The first question I want to ask you is how you got yourself to China. What took you to China, and what were you doing there?
What was I doing there? Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure what I was thinking at the time, but no, basically I finished my undergraduate degree, and the immediate job prospects of someone who majors in psychology and doesn't do honors and masters and all that aren't that great in something psychology related. So I sort of took what was to be a gap year that turned into almost 3 years, basically teaching college students English, or, you know, trying to improve their English, because by college, Chinese students already have a pretty good basic grounding in English. But basically the universities and colleges over there hire native speakers to help students with their listening and pronunciation and just cultural stuff as well.
How's your Chinese now?
It's probably not as good as it should be after a few years there, but it's I wouldn't say conversational. I can survive if I had to.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I can order the chicken versus the beef or whatever it is. And that's enough. But working there actually as a foreign English teacher, all your classes, all your work is actually in English.
Okay.
And no one there wants to, like, if they're students, they don't want to talk to you in Chinese.
No, I can imagine, yeah.
Yeah, because it's your job to talk to them in English. But yeah, so, no, it should be a bit better, I think. But
How do you find the system over there compared to, and certainly for marketing graduates, because obviously as a population size, you know, they must be throwing out, you know, hundreds of thousands of marketing graduates every year versus what perhaps Australia is generating. What are the one big difference that you saw in the education system over there that you see here?
Well, this was before I got into marketing, so I can't sort of talk to the marketing aspect so much other than that sort of, yeah, that's, as you've described, generally how it works. But, you know, they've got, not millions, but many, many times more businesses and things than we have here too. So it kind of works proportionally. But in terms of the education system, it's even in university, it's still very much, they don't teach a lot around learning how to think and how to be creative and how to problem right. solve. It's very much rote learning.
Yeah.
For whatever it may be. And actually, the high school system is grueling over there. They have, you know, 12-hour days, 6 days a week throughout all of high school. And then they get to college or university and it's like a holiday. They treat it as that and that can be a bit frustrating for a teacher. Yeah. But it's the intensity of the high school system sounds insane to me. Yeah. And I can't imagine doing it. Yeah. I didn't love high school myself. Didn't mind university so much. But yeah, the big difference is that probably that creativity and that the learning about free thinking. But that all ties into the whole, you know, the entire
culture
and also the governance of that country and how that all works. And yeah, that's a big topic.
So it got you got back to Australia in 2010, 2011.
Yep.
How did you arrive at Marketing Magazine? And what was it like? Because I think one of the questions I obviously really wanted to ask you is that you've gone through this, and I call it sort of a magazine Armageddon, a print media Armageddon that sort of occurred in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And that must have been a interesting time to move into print media, and especially in a marketing print media as well.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I'll go back to first part of the question around how I got into it. Was I started studying, it was a Master of Commerce and wanted to major in marketing, but then sort of took some classes in advertising and communications and made some friends in there. And basically I ended up switching over to a Master of Communications in advertising. But during that met a good friend who worked at Niche Media, at Marketing Magazine, and she one day said, hey, she knew I was looking for a job and said, hey, the company's looking for a receptionist, and the receptionists generally often move on to something else in the business. So I actually got a job as a receptionist and did that.
I can't see you as a receptionist.
No one could either, because I was probably one of the worst they've ever had. So I did that for 6 months, but during that time, I was finishing some uni assignments as well, but did a little bit of writing for the Marketing Mag team there, because I had a bit of spare time. It's not nonstop as a receptionist in a small business. Well, it wasn't for me. I was probably not the person you should ask about how to do it properly. But yeah, just after about 6 months, and they were looking for someone to come on as a writer and I guess online or assistant editor. They were nice enough to hire me.
Right. Okay. And so so back to the sort of second part of that question. What was the feeling when you were sort of amongst this print media Armageddon that you sort of walked into?
Yeah, the print media Armageddon, that's, you know, maybe a good word, but it's a very slow burning Armageddon. It's been, you know, it's probably 15 years, well, the start of it, maybe even 20 years old, and it's been like and I'm talking more generally here about the industry, a tsunami happening at glacial speeds, because but without being, what am I trying to say? Without the major players still having time to react the right ways, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it does.
It's happened so slowly, but still, the major players have handled it very badly, like probably the whole way along.
It's like a car crash that you can see coming towards you, and yeah, you're just standing staring at the headlights. Yeah,
yeah, like deer in headlights stuff. But I should say, in magazines and especially in B2B publishing, or at least in like trade publications like Markley Merg and the others that we do at Niche Media, or that they do now. Still getting used to saying that.
Past tense.
Is that they've been quite well sheltered from say the effects that general daily newspapers have experienced. So, and I mean, the main reason for that is that a piece of paper delivered every day with the news from yesterday has not been the most efficient way to get your news for a very long time.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the difference being with say marketing magazine is we haven't been trying to do news for a very long time, and there is still a good enough portion of our audience that liked and still does like reading in print, and the content is meant to be evergreen, or at least, you know, relevant for quite a long time.
Did you find that there were still some things that you had to do to protect that readership? I mean, it's a great point that, you know, you're not the next day's news, but was there still some evolutionary things that you needed to change?
That kind of is not the problem, and wasn't the problem with the readership side of things. Has never been where the money comes from. It's been a bit of the money,
yeah,
and it's sort of like the money you make from selling copies of magazines might cover the printing costs, for example, and distribution costs through subscription and through selling it through newsagents. But the bulk of the money, and this is where the businesses like Niche have been hit really hard, is that print advertising has been in decline, and that's where the vast majority of revenue has been for, you know, 40 years is the print advertising. So that's what's declined over the last 10 years, 15 years, where the demand for online advertising has, well, during my time, it basically did the invert point. That makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the problem with that is you do theoretically have unlimited or a lot more inventory you can sell, but the actual prices and margins on online advertising, or, you know, whether that's advertising or content or whatever it is, are a lot lower than they were in print. So you could have the same pool of clients with the same budgets, but, well, also because of fragmentation, you're getting less of that. But because one page in a print magazine might be a few thousand dollars.
Yeah.
To make up for that, you're actually doing a lot more work online, in an online sense. So that's the challenge at the business level.
What do you think the future holds for the print media industry? Do you think we're going to see the end of you know, printed newspapers? Do you think we've reached the bottom of that cycle now, and there potentially is it's just going to flatline, or we're going to see, you know, a regrowth of that kind of information? And I ask that because, interestingly, I've seen in the past 2 or 3 months a few media, online media outlets start to send out emails with what I would probably call like comprehensive emails. So they're really in-depth, singular emails about one particular topic. Right. They're long-form articles, essentially, in an email.
Right.
And okay. QZ.com do one that I get every few days. LinkedIn have started sending them out and things like that. And I wonder if you think there's a turning point, where what's happened in the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's still a place for print. Now, that type of newsletter, I think, is going to become more popular. I mean, that having said that, that type of newsletter has been around for a very long time. Mm. Now, email has been around for a very long time.
Yeah.
And that's sort of another thing that people talk about the death of with every new social network or whatever comes along. But email is not going anywhere.
No.
Print, you know, eventually, yes. I think for newspapers, definitely. I reckon, you know, it won't be too long before they do what they've been saying and cut down to just weekend editions, for example.
Yeah.
For, you know, if you get a marketing magazine, I always saw it having a place, and even if it wasn't like, I mean, basically it had become, rather than being the center of the business model, it had become one of the arms of the business model, the print magazine.
Absolutely.
And so that, even beyond just revenue, it was important in other ways, such as, you know, the branding of our own brand, for example.
Yeah.
Having that. So, you know, who knows? I'm not there anymore, so don't get to put my 2 cents into the discussions anymore. But there was never like a serious discussions about ending it while I was there.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not under no illusions that one day it won't end, but I'm sure that'll happen at some point. But.
Well, I think your point there is that's the real key one, was where you said it becomes part of a suite of brands, you know, and instead of it being the cornerstone and the main revenue generator, it becomes one of a few different channels of revenue generation.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what, like, and that's the evolution that media brands have.
Yeah.
They've sort of brought in over during these, you know, last decade or two, have kind of had some realizations and started to think like marketers, basically.
Yeah.
And gone, we've got a brand, and there can be, there's a print publication attached to it, there's an online publication, but there can be events.
Yeah.
And events, actually, for publishers is where the money is these days.
Absolutely.
So it's the events subsidizing the other things rather than the say the print as it was, you know,
I think
10 years ago, print subsidizing a website, for example.
Yeah. I think the irony that the point that you just made there is that publishers need to act more like brands. And in the last 5 to 10 years, you've seen brands trying to act more like publishers.
Well, that's true.
And there's this kind of point where they all meet in the middle and suddenly realize that they're all doing the same thing now.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting shift from both ends of the demographic.
Well, it is. And I mean, in terms of trends, we'll definitely see more and more of brand publishing. And like, there's a lot. And so the other half of my job over the last couple of years was custom publishing or content marketing. And so for brands like Bank of Melbourne, so that's only in Victoria, obviously, so you won't have seen it anywhere else, but they've done a print publication with us for the last few years, around for small businesses, around, you know, inspiring stories from around Victoria and small business and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Very much not at all advertising or advertorial even. They controlled the advertising, so they had ads in the magazine, but it looked like they didn't even, there was no logo on the cover. They were very, very tasteful about it because that's fit their brand. But I mean, it depends on the brand you're talking about. But I think there will be more of that, not necessarily only in print, but for luxury brands, or at least high-end brands, print will be, you know, still a powerful tool.
Well, I actually would challenge that as well, because I just finished a job 2 weeks ago, actually not a week ago, with a client that was a very small business, so 5-6 employees. And the final thing I did working with them was to help them produce an 8-page magazine.
Right.
And they got a copywriter in who had produced 4 or 5 good quality articles around their industry. They'd gone and got a graphic designer, and the aim was to produce 1,000 of these that they would send out to obviously existing clients, potential clients, so on and so forth. Mm. And interestingly, the cost to produce that wasn't huge. And they felt that was a good ROI to, rather than keep ringing up people or knocking on people's doors, that sending them a magazine was going to interrupt them and make them think about ordering from them better than hassling them on email or hassling them on a phone. So that they wouldn't hassle them on the phone and hassle them on email as well, but it was that point of difference I felt. So I think custom publication is an opportunity for every business if they've got a budget and they can write and they can, you know, that sort of thing. So
And I mean, the challenge always is, you know, and this is the main objection, is how do we know what it's doing and if it's worth the money. And that's where digital has hurt the sort of print channels, you know, in marketing in general over the last little while, because it's measurable, but, you know, it's arguable about, you know, you're measuring how it's going, but are you measuring the effects and last click and attribution and all of that?
But it
has sort of educated marketers and business people, some of them, to a point where they sort of know to ask about that, but don't really understand it. Now, I can't tell you how to measure how your print publication is going to go, because it, you know, it depends on how you're measuring everything else and, you know, what you're trying to do and all of that. And it is very hard, but it does work. It's just hard to show how.
I think you have to be really focused on it. I think you have to believe in the medium and believe that people are going to read it. And certainly in the industry I was dealing with, it was a very enclosed industry. People had been, you know, people, once they got in that industry, they stayed in that industry for a long time. So certainly the owner of this business felt that would be well received. I want to move on to a question, because I think the thing that sort of I really wanted to talk to you about is that you've with your time with Marketing Magazine, you've seen a lot of stuff. You've seen some, you see some good campaigns, you see some bad campaigns, and you've probably seen a hell of a lot of mediocre campaigns in the middle of them. And I wanted to get some of your favorites. I wanted to get an idea of some of your favorites. But before you do that, we had a conversation in the earlier part of this show about the recent Dove campaign.
Oh, okay.
And I'm sure you would have seen it.
And the Facebook photo.
Yeah, with the rotating GIF with the black woman taking her shirt off and turning into a white woman.
Yeah.
I just wanted to get your feeling, because we certainly felt, or at least, you know, some of the people I've spoken to felt, that it was actually a deliberate attempt for Dove to sort of poke the hornet's nest of social media in order to get a reaction.
Yeah. Well, it could well be. And I mean, I'm by this point fairly cynical. It could well be deliberate. I mean, I don't believe, I mean, a company like Dove, or are they Unilever, or they're, you know, part of a conglomerate.
Yeah, I think they
are. There's a lot of moving parts to that, and agencies and stuff. And so it's interesting what they can get away with, because there's plausible deniability, you know, if you're not directly involved. And they say, you know, they will say there's a social media team that runs this, there's a content team, or there's an agency, or whatever it is. At the same time, I don't believe that a business like that that doesn't have the checks and balances and the marketing governance frameworks in place for it, for that stuff to happen. Having said that, it's not the first time. I don't think the first time even for Dove.
No,
I can't remember. And but you know, are they on purpose? It's hard to say. I mean, I do genuinely feel people in agencies and close to brands get so close to them that they do get into a little bubble and can really misread, or not even misread, but just miss the general, you know, they're out of touch.
Out of touch with this public sentiment in that kind of area.
Or with how people might react to it.
It's. I'll tell you what, I mean, I up until about an hour ago, I thought it was just I just generally thought it was a bad call on Dove's part. And like you said, perhaps they got stuck in this bubble. And then I saw an interview with the black girl.
I saw an article by her or something.
And I saw the interview on the BBC's website. And I'll try and link it into the show notes here so people can see it. And that felt very staged. That point I kind of went, you know, this would, the timing of all of this, I mean, Dove had released it and apologized. And if I were Dove, I would then sweep it under the, just forget that it ever happened and move on.
Well, that's the normal corporate response to things. It's, you know, silence or, you know, limited statement and then wait a little while. But yeah, you're right.
To re-poke the hornet's nest again with that video of her talking about how it wasn't an issue for her.
Yeah.
Then the cynicism in me kind of came to the surface and went, this was all a state. This was all staged.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah.
So back to that again, to the first part of that question. Then, what brands have you admired over the last over your time at Niche? What have you looked at and just gone, wow, that's a good activation, or that's a good campaign, or they're doing that really well? Just things that have kind of made you feel that sort of warm and fuzziness inside.
Warm and fuzziness. From a
if you can't feel warm and fuzziness towards advertising and marketing.
Why not phrase it like warm and fuzzy?
Okay. But we'll think of something like else.
Anyway, we'll dub this later. Better words. I don't know. It's all the big ones that this been actually. And to be honest, I was thinking about this the other day and trying to think. And I have a pretty bad memory, unprompted memory of the things. But I mean, it's all the big things that stand out to me that are, you know, stand out. You know, that reach the mainstream press, so everyone knows about them. It's things like, I mean, I was really impressed. And this isn't not at all intelligent thing to say after so many years, but Share a Coke being developed in Australia by the Australian Coca-Cola marketing team, and then doing so well it got picked up around the world.
That was the one where people's names labels were on the cans.
People's names on them, yeah.
All the cans.
I think the first round they had, it was like mate or dad and all of that sort of stuff, and then people's names. But that, we ran a case study on that after it had happened in Australia, and it probably still is now. It's still one of the highest read articles on our website every month to this day. It's that was in 2012. That we published that, and so they would have run in 2011, or summer of 2011, 2012 maybe.
I thought that was I mean, I've just from my point of view, its simplicity was the best thing about it.
Yeah.
It was, you know, there was no overly complicated, you know, media or creative. It was print some people's names on the cans on the bottom.
Well, and it's your own, using your own channel of distribution for I mean, obviously there's a lot of advertising around it.
Yeah.
It tied in really well. And yeah, like you said, a really simple campaign. But I mean, the Australian developed angle was really nice too, because so much, you know, well, I'm talking about international brands here or local marketing teams working for international brands, they don't get to come up with stuff very often. A lot of it's just, you know, cut and paste what HQ has done in the key market or the home market or whatever other market. So yeah, so that was really nice. Being a Melbourne guy, Dumb Ways to Die, just amazing how that how that took off around the world. I mean, I don't, just shows the power of catchy jingle and
tell us a little bit more about that, because a lot of people may not have seen that. So sort of give us a snapshot of that campaign.
Well, Dumb Ways to Die was by, the agency was McCann Melbourne, but for Metro Trains Melbourne. So basically the Metro train line down here.
Yeah.
And it's basically a railway safety commercial, or it's more of a brand platform because it's been going on for years and years. It's about probably 4 years old now, and I think it was always intended to be at least 5 years. But it's I'm not going to sing it. You can link to the videos and stuff.
I won't ask you to sing it. Yeah.
But just a really catchy jingle and cartoons. And basically, I mean, you could, the argument's making light of stupid people getting hit by trains. That's the point of it, really.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably why it worked so well. People don't need another authoritative, you know, black and white granny video with the Grim Reaper voice over it telling them to be safe around trains.
I think the Kiwis did a good one, didn't they? I think it was the, I just always remember Ghost Chips, where they were talking about...
Oh, Ghost Chips, yeah.
Yeah, where...
Drink driving, I think.
Yeah, they were using comedy in the vein of that age demographic to reach out to them rather than the shock tactics.
Yeah, absolutely. And in Victoria, I mean, I think, I'm not 100% sure about this, but the TAC, the Road Safety Bureau, has... since the 80s has basically done so much shock tactic work, and it's every TV ad it puts out since the 80s. And I think the first in Australia to go that far and actually make it really, really quite distressing type TV ads. But it's basically, you can't keep doing that. You have to one-up yourself every time or it stops working with shock tactics. And so they've been doing that for 30 years. In Victoria, at least, that's what I can speak to, is a radical departure from that by Dumb Ways to Die.
Yeah.
Was probably the exact right move. And it's become a phenomenon. I think the characters ended up getting licensed by a city railway in the US for them to use.
Yeah.
There's plush toys, app games. It's now became the most awarded campaign ever.
Right.
Like globally in Cannes, at least.
Okay.
You know, ever, out of everything in the world, which is insane. The tricky question is to ask, well, now that it's approaching its run of 5 years, has it worked? Yeah. And I don't have the data on that. I mean, railway safety awareness undoubtedly has risen.
Yeah.
But it'll be the numbers that, you know, I always want to
absolutely
know about effectiveness, instead of just, you know, Adland giving.
Yeah.
It's friends awards, or not its friends, but Adland awarding itself for being creative and making fun stuff, which, you know, is what it does. But yeah,
just
the results, and that's when
I was going to say going off on a tangent like that. Do you think there's too much of that? Obviously, you know, there were some issues, I think 2-3 years ago, with some of the Cairns awards going to campaigns that had never run, or
I think there is too much of it. I mean, agency land is very good at, I guess, at least within its own walls, inflating itself. And it's been good to see, I guess, more recently, although, I mean, things like the Effies bringing effectiveness back into it, and the rise of the Effies over the years has been good to see, like having to prove effectiveness beyond just, you know, creativity and whatever is important. Having said that, I mean, a lot of agencies don't get all the data themselves. It's confidential with the client, and so it's tough. But yeah, no, I mean, in general, the advertising agency world is, you know, to be fun to be part of for a while, but it takes itself very seriously.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think overinflates its own importance just a tad.
That's probably understatement of the year. So those are, I mean, obviously there's a couple of great examples there of campaigns. Is there anything that you've seen in those years where you've just gone, either you've questioned it and just gone, this isn't going to work, and it has worked, or things that you've seen and you've gone, this isn't going to work, and you were absolutely right. you know, what are some of the more disaster prone brands aside from Dove, but campaigns that you've seen?
To be honest, like the rate of me looking at something and going, what the hell is that? Or it's not going to work. It's probably like 90% of the things I was seeing on a daily basis. I got better at realizing that, you know, I can't just look at something and say I enjoy that and it's therefore it's good. It's the old problem with marketing and realizing your customer is not yourself.
Yeah,
you know, usually. But yeah, I mean, I can't really think of any examples.
That's okay.
But a lot.
Yeah,
like I would look at stuff. You know, we'd see stuff on a daily basis, obviously, and you know, really just remembering them the next day would be a challenge. Yeah. 99% of the time.
Yeah, there's a lot of filler out there.
And
a lot of agencies are being paid for that filler.
And it may well work though. Like for, you know, does a job. I mean, boring TV ads.
You look at Auto-Tune. Was it Auto-Tune?
With
the two girls in PVC.
Yeah, well, that definitely wasn't boring.
No,
but very questionable in many other ways, yeah. But at least it wasn't boring.
But it did what he said that, you know, the owner of that company set it out to do, which was draw attention to their business in a particular demographic and upset other demographics in the process.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, and a lot of debate around that because they're talking about the reality versus the perceived, you know, shopping power of women versus men, even in industries of categories like that. But he came out and said it had worked really well and they're making shitloads of money, so he doesn't care what people think. But I think that was his attitude for it the whole way.
A couple of other questions I want to ask you generally that, I mean, obviously now you're out of the publishing circle and you could potentially end up absolutely anywhere next. When you sit and look at people starting businesses or early stage businesses, what are some of the tips that if you were forced to sit down and give someone and give them, you know, some tips about how to run a business or how to launch a business, or obviously more importantly, how to market their business, what are the things that sort of really stuck out to you that by that question, I mean the very basics, you know, the first steps that people should be doing properly.
Yeah. I'll preface this by saying I'm in no way qualified to give business advice, and you should always get a second opinion.
Ask a professional
on this, and take this as entertainment content only. Put that in very small print. But one of the things I would say, and it's something you learn, or I learned over the years of just basically being exposed to noise from hundreds of different sources every day, is that it can seem, and it does seem, extremely confusing and extremely complicated. But at the end of the day, and this is where the lesson is for anyone running or marketing a business, it all boils back to first principles of marketing. Like as much as we debate, you know, the 4 P's and the 7 C's the 20 P's and all of that, you can't actually get away from, you know, the original 4 P's of marketing back in Kotler's day. You can change them a bit and come up with new stuff, but it sort of still boils down to that, I would say. And Philip Kotler would say, and he did say to us when we asked him that question, we've got a video on our YouTube page where we asked him that, but So if it all sounds too much, and marketing technology and advertising technology especially has done itself no service with the amount of confusion that industry has created, which is, you know, actually we could get into this if you want to, but created a massive problem around transparency and shot itself in the foot a little bit.
We could, but I was going to say, I don't. That's probably another hour's conversation later on that we might save for another day, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because, agencies as well are a big part of that. But, yeah, I mean, what was I trying to say? that when it all seems really complex, it's actually not. You're never gonna stop, you know, having to create a decent product or a service. And I think that's the first place you focus, because if you get that right, then the other things become a whole lot easier. But in terms of promotion, you basically start with one thing, and it's number one in your list, or three things, depending on how big the business is and how much money you've got to play with, and if you've got someone you can put on it full time and all of that. Yeah. But simplicity. My overriding philosophy to basically everything is simplicity.
Keeping
it simple.
I've spoken to, you know, so many businesses of all shapes and sizes in the last 8 to 10 years, and the first question I always ask them is what do you want to achieve? And it's amazing that 90% of them have no comprehension of at least where they're going. So
that's a really good point.
Trying to build a strategic map for them when they don't know where they're going is near to impossible.
And this, and one way simplicity, if you actually really stick to that, plays out is with everything you do, you pick one thing.
Yeah.
Like if you're saying if you've got business goals, pick one thing. It's going to be, if you, every goal you add to something, it makes it more than twice as hard.
Yeah.
And waters it down. So, yeah. And I mean, the other thing I'd say is around the segmentation thing, which sort of kind of goes back to the Ultra Tune example, but you don't have to be exactly like that.
Yeah.
It is around, don't worry about, you know, you've got to pick your target, and who cares what other people say.
Yeah.
I mean, that doesn't mean making the other people angry, like in some examples, although it can. It just means, you know, if they don't raise an eyebrow, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. I think...
Because trying to be... Yeah, I think Mark Ritson says as well, but if you try to be... Everyone likes vanilla, but they never choose vanilla if there's chocolate available.
Yeah, yeah. I think Apple do that.
Some people do
that extremely well, that they've got a very key understanding of who their target market are, you know, and they just go after them. And that's, you know, not to the point where they're upsetting everybody else, but, you know, there's a target market that will pay $1,000 for an iPhone, and that's their market, you know.
Yeah. So, and there's a brand, the cool Australian brand that has been acquired, but Vino Mofo, online wine retailer that's, you know, not doing anything majorly different, but the way they've branded themselves for the younger audience and the language they use is just, and they're just nailing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that sort of leads me to last few questions. What are some of the brands that you like? What are the, and I know you've talked about some case studies and things like that, but what's something you buy all the time because you like the brand, or something that you drive? And I'm putting you on the spot here, or even clothing companies or retail outlets, or, you know, is there anything that you just go, I'm always going to, you know, I mean, obviously I've mentioned Apple because, you know, I'm sitting here with
I mean, Apple's one. I'm an Apple user. I haven't sort of done the self-analysis to decide whether I do it just for the brand or whatever. I mean, once they've got you, it becomes a barrier to change type equation. Yeah. So you just stick with what you know. But funnily enough, in clothing and stuff, I'm not anti-brands, but I'm not into logos. It's just a personal choice. And not into logos on t-shirts or on anything, actually. So I do a lot of shopping in ASOS and Top Man and stuff like that, where it's sort of not unbranded, but branding is not heavy. I don't know. I own a lot of books, and I, you know, looking at the Penguin Classics, orange and white, or orange and cream.
Yeah.
that's design a, of their covers.
Yeah, that's a, always, yeah, that's a classic me. Brand, actually. That's one that you...
I can stare at that.
Yeah, that you gravitate towards. In the
before my time at Marketing Mag, they did a profile on the cover of the mag was the orange and cream stripes.
That's a good
bands
example.
Across the cover. What else? I don't know.
Do you gravitate to a particular car? Is there a, like, if you go and get a job next week that says you can have whatever car you like, is there, you know?
Yeah.
Is there,
ooh, whatever car I like. that changes things because that's not my normal criteria. I don't drive, but, well, not much anyway, but my wife drives, and so we have a Ford, and we've had, I'm not sure why, but it possibly this is related. My dad's always had Fords, so that's possibly a family thing. But yeah, no, in terms of other stuff, I'm more of an explorer. Okay. And if I find something of good quality,
yeah,
and I'm sort of thinking in the clothing and household stuff these days, then I'll stick with it. But yeah,
what final question for you, which is I'll give it to you as a two-part question. What's next for Peter Roper? And what if a potential employer happens to be listening to this, what's next for you? And the second question part of that is then what's next for marketing with things like AI and voice technology and all those kind of bits? What do you see happening in the sort of the next 5-10 years?
Well, first part, for me, the answer is I don't know, and that was deliberate. I elected to take some time off, but might be in publishing again, or possibly an in-house role. Going back to brands I like, it'd have to be in a business that I can get passionate about or am passionate about. Yeah. So whether it's the values of that brand or in an industry I want to move into, like food and wine or something, whether that's in publishing or in marketing or in-house or all of that, or something in social enterprise. I'm getting into reading a lot and learning a lot more about things like service design and things like that at the moment, so I'm getting sort of, I don't know, just I'm not doing nothing while I'm unemployed. Keeping the brain ticking over, so, and that includes preparing for conversations like this, so thank you. I'm not quite a vegetable yet after 2 weeks at home, but the second part of your question around marketing, and I mean this does sort of hark back to what I said around the business advice, is that everything boils back. During my time, even in the 6 years or 7 years I was there, and you start to see the patterns.
Yeah.
And so right now it's AI and virtual reality and blah, blah, blah. 6 years ago it was, we're still talking about social media at that sort of buzz level that AI is now. Similarly with things like marketing technology and advertising technology, even though they're not new, they've changed, or advertising technology has changed a lot, with programmatic becoming the norm. But you replace sort of those words and you just sort of see the patterns every X number of months or X number of years. Soon we'll stop talking about AI, and we'll probably never even mention AI unless you're talking about data analysis fields and things like that. It'll just be, virtual assistants and all of that. So they'll become the norm. I mean, 6 years ago we were still talking about digital, or seven years ago, we're still talking about digital as a separate thing. And I mean, that back then, so we realized, this isn't really going to be a thing for much longer. So that's probably how it works, and that is how publishing works. You milk the hot topics while you can to create content. We were back then talking about massive structural changes to marketing, and I think I didn't come up with this, but we overestimate the short-term potential of technologies to change how we do things.
Yeah.
We underestimate long term, but in short term, we overestimate. So, I mean, it's going to be, well, I can fairly safely put $10 on, you know, in the next 10 years, the marketer's job is not going to change fundamentally, just as it hasn't over the last 40 years.
Yeah.
It's still about delivering value. And hope what I do see changing is the type of value that marketing delivers. And that's as opposed to broadcast advertising. We've seen it with the evolution of content marketing, where that's actually delivering, you know, useful stuff,
yeah,
where it, when it's done well, delivering useful stuff to customers, but it's marketing.
Yeah.
And with you know, one of the columnists in marketing, Sergio Brodsky, this is a hot topic for him, and I encourage people to read what he's written around it, but around brand utility, where it sort of takes content or takes delivering value, you know, from not just content that has utility, but you know the sky's the limit. What else can deliver utility? That might be public Wi-Fi, or it might be private public partnerships to, you know, to service neighborhoods in X category, or, you know, that sort of thing. I hope is, because there's a lot of positives to that, is what we're going to see a lot more of.
Mate, it's been absolutely fascinating. It's been too long since we've had a conversation, and all the last conversations we've had, I think one or both of us have been drunk. So this is nice to chat where we're...
Oh, wait, you're not right now. Oh, I am.
Well, you've got all this time, time off, yeah. No, it's been fantastic to talk to you. So thank you very much.
People won't know we're doing this at like 9 o'clock in the morning.
No,
I shouldn't have just said that.
Tell them it's 3 a.m. If people want to find you, if they do want to offer you a job, where's the best place for them to find you?
LinkedIn.
Yep.
Probably. LinkedIn's good. I've actually been paying more attention to that. I used to get a lot of invitations to connect from people I had, you know, never even heard of. And a lot of messages as well, but now I am actually seeing who the messages are from because of my current
employment situation.
But yeah, LinkedIn's probably the best. Okay. I mean, I'm on Twitter, but I don't use that very much.
Fantastic. Well, once again, thank you very much to Peter Roper. It's been a wonderful talk.
Thank you, Simon.
Thank you for your time.
Appreciate it, Simon. Thanks a lot for having me.
So this week I'm going to do look at something a little bit different instead of your standard piece of software, although you could call this software, you might not call it software. Perhaps we're going to expand this segment to include maybe service-based products as well as software, but things I think that you will find useful to your business. And the one that I've been using a lot of in the past few months is a service called Unsplash. That's UN and then splash.com. Now, it is essentially a stock image website. But the beauty of it is that every single image on it is free to download and free to use. And that might seem a bit of a catch. And so far, I've been using it now for a couple of months, and I'm still trying to find out what that catch is, if there is one. But some of the photography, in fact, to be honest with you, most of the photography, 95% of the photography on there is absolutely beautiful. It's stunning. It's professional. It's all sorts of things. It might be cityscapes, close-ups, abstracts, people, all those kind of things. It is absolutely perfect to use for a potential mock-up of an ad campaign, or you want to use it for a blog photo, but there's lots and lots of things that you could do with it. I use them for my blog photos on simondell.com, and I use them for the cover photos of blogs and all those kind of things. So they absolutely work perfectly. I found a great one that I've actually used as a banner on a website that I've developed. So there's a lot on there, and it's huge, and it's growing. It seems to be growing really quickly. There's a huge amount of new photos going up every week. And if you sign up, you get an email saying, here's all of our best new photos. They create collections that you can download. It really is a fantastic service and well worth checking out. So that's unsplash.com. The one thing I say you're not going to find there, you are not going to find those specific nasty stock images that you see that have been used so many times. If I see a goldfish jumping from one goldfish bowl to another goldfish bowl again, I will probably pull my hair out. And if I find people using those on their website, it drives me absolutely nuts. But so what I do, go and check it out. I think it's absolutely fantastic. I think it's got some great images in there. I actually credit the photographers. It does ask you to credit the photographers on the website. So at the bottom of my blogs, I always put the link to the photographer because, obviously I think that's only fair. So once again, we've come to the end of the show. Hope you've enjoyed it. There's a couple of things that I would ask of you before we go. Number one, we'd love you to rate this. We'd hopefully see this now on iTunes and the Android podcast or whatever that's called. We're also going to have this on SoundCloud and my own website. If you want to find out more about us, if you want to follow me, I'm on Twitter. My handle is I am Simon Bell. You can also find me on LinkedIn and Facebook just by putting my name in. And we've just got our new Instagram account. There's nothing right on it at the moment. By the time you listen to this, hopefully there will be. And you can find us on Instagram at Simon Dell Podcast. The final credit I would like to give is to our producer, Gilberto. And you can find his website at welovesound.audio. Once again, thank you very much for listening in. We are going to have another episode coming up next week or in a couple of weeks' time. Really appreciate it. And once again, just a quick reminder to give us a review and a rating. Thanks very much.